When late afternoon arrived, Vanetta had to be back for her GED class.
"Don't go," said Crystal. "I can't miss. I want that diploma,"
Vanetta answered.
"You can't miss?"
"Only in a real emergency."
"Bitch, you looking for housing. This is a real emergency."
Vanetta smiled and left. Crystal was supposed to continue the housing search, but she decided to stop by her church instead. Mount Calvary Pentecostal Church was on 60th and National, on the far southwest side of the city, but still accessible by bus. It was a handsome brick building with stained glass windows and rain gutters painted fire engine red. It was Monday night, so the church's food pantry was open. Crystal picked up a bag of groceries and accepted a hot dog from her minister. Bishop Dixon teased Crystal about texting during the service, and Crystal countered by asking the old man if his teeth ever fell out when he was giving the blessing. She told Sister Italia to bring her dog to church.
"Why not? Maybe she can get the word, too."
They laughed. Elder Johnson was there in a preachy mood. "If we really got Jesus in our souls," he said, "I'm supposed to be able to feel your pain, and you're supposed to be able to feel my pain." Elder Johnson didn't feel Crystal's pain. It wasn't that he didn't care, like Vanetta thought. It was that he didn't know. Elder Johnson, Bishop Dixon, Sister Italia, none of them knew Crystal was staying at the lodge. Only Minister Barber knew. Crystal didn't want members of her church to reduce her, to see her as an object of pity, a member of the poor and the orphaned. She wanted to be seen as Sister Crystal, part of the body, the beloved. Crystal received a bag of food once in a while, and congregants had opened their homes to her for a night or two. But her church was in no way equipped to meet Crystal's high-piled needs. What her church could offer was the peace.
"What's your favorite verse, sister?"
Elder Johnson asked. He had seen Crystal lift one of the nearby Bibles.
"Don't be trying to put me on the spot."
She smiled. Then she said, "Though he slay me, yet will I trust him." Crystal and Vanetta kept looking for a place to live. Sometimes, Vanetta took her kids with her. Sometimes, she took them to the daycare or to stay with her older sister, Ebony. Vanetta had them with her when she and Crystal visited their 32nd apartment on 15th Street and Madison. The landlord stepped out of his sob and opened the door to a small two-bedroom unit. The showing was scheduled in the evening because the landlord had a government day job in Madison. He was a well-fed Puerto Rican man in pleated slacks and a dress shirt. The place was small, dumpy, and without a bathtub. After a walkthrough, Vanetta asked the landlord if he had any other units with tubs. He said he did, and began describing another apartment. It was bigger and somewhat nicer than the place he was showing Vanetta and Crystal, but the rent was the same. Then, suddenly, as if forgetting something, the man stopped himself. His hand went for his pocket, and he answered his cell phone. It was obvious to Vanetta and Crystal that no one had called, but he pretended to have a conversation. Hanging up, the landlord said that it had been his partner on the other line, and that he had just rented out the bigger and nicer unit. The women stood outside and watched the sob pull away. Crystal reached for her old MP3 player and put in headphones. Vanetta was shaking.
"I'm so angry," she whispered. "Get it together, you have to heal your heart,"
Crystal sang, eyes closed, swaying back and forth.
"He just like, oh, they black. They trash the place anyways."
Vanetta wiped a tear away with a quick swipe and sucked in her quivering bottom lip. Her kids looked up at her, confused.
"Get it together, you can fly, fly."
Crystal lifted her voice. Most Milwaukeeans believed their city was racially segregated because people preferred it that way. But the ghetto had always been more a product of social design than desire. It was never a byproduct of the modern city, a sad accident of industrialization and urbanization, something no one benefited from nor intended. The ghetto had always been a main feature of landed capital, a prime moneymaker for those who saw ripe opportunity in land scarcity, housing dilapidation, and racial segregation. Maybe it began in the late 15th century, the weaponry of war to blame. With the invention of the iron cannonball, cities could no longer rely on moats and modest ramparts to fend off attack. complicated systems of defense had to be constructed, and cities had to grow vertically behind high walls. Old Geneva and Paris saw tenements climb 6 stories. Edinburgh boasted of tenements twice as high. While agrarian families were driven from the land to increasingly congested cities, the competition for space drove up land values and rents. Urban landlords quickly realized that piles of money could be made by creating slums. Maximum profits came not from providing first-class accommodations for those who could well afford them, but from crowded slum accommodations for those whose pennies were scarcer than the rich man's pounds. Beginning in the 16th century, slum housing would be reserved not only for outcasts, beggars, and thieves, but for a large segment of the population. During its rapid period of urbanization, America imported this model. Colonial proprietors adopted the institutions and laws of England's landed gentry, including the doctrine of absolute liability for rent, which held tenants unequivocally responsible for payments, even in the event of fire or flood. Throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, America's poor lived in cellars, attics, cattle sheds, and windowless rooms that held multiple families. Some slums were cut off from basic municipal services and local wells, so families begged for water in other parts of town. Rents continued to rise as living conditions deteriorated. Soon, many families could not afford their housing. When this happened, landlords could summon the privilege of distress, which entitled them to seize and sell tenants' property to recover lost profit, a practice that persisted well into the 20th century. Racial oppression enabled land exploitation on a massive scale. During slavery, black slaves pulled profit from the dirt, but had no claim to the land. After the Civil War, freed slaves saw in land ownership the possibility of true liberation, but during Reconstruction, wealthy whites maintained a virtual monopoly on the soil as lands seized from or abandoned by Confederates were restored to their original owners. Returning to plantations as sharecroppers, black families descended into a cycle of subsistence farming and debt, while white planters continued to grow rich. The slave shacks stood, and so did the plantation mansions. In the early decades of the 20th century, African-American families seeking freedom and good jobs participated in the Great Migration, moving en masse from the rural South to cities like Chicago, Philadelphia, and Milwaukee. When they arrived in those cities, they were crowded into urban ghettos, and the vast majority depended on landlords for housing. Ghetto landlords had a segregated and captive tenant base and had nothing to gain by improving their rundown houses. They began dividing their properties into small kitchenette units, throwing up so many plywood walls their apartments resembled rabbit warrens. Many houses lacked heating and complete plumbing. So black families cooked and ate in winter coats and relieved themselves in outhouses or homemade toilets. They came to know well the sound of the tuberculosis cough. In 1930, the death rate for Milwaukee's blacks was nearly 60% higher than the citywide rate, due, in large part, to poor housing conditions. For the first time in the history of America, New Deal policies made homeownership a real possibility for white families. But black families were denied these benefits when the federal government deemed their neighborhoods too risky for insured mortgages, and officials loyal to Jim Crow blocked black veterans from using GI mortgages. Over 3 centuries of systematic dispossession from the land created a semi-permanent black rental class and an artificially high demand for inner-city apartments. In the 1950s, white real estate brokers developed an advanced technique of exploitation, one that targeted black families shut out of the private housing market. After buying houses on the cheap from nervous white homeowners in transitioning neighborhoods, private investors would sell these houses on contract to black families for double or triple their assessed value. Black buyers had to come up with sizable down payments, often upwards of 25% of the property's inflated value. Once they moved in, black families had all the responsibilities of home ownership without any of the rights. When families missed payments, which many did after monthly installments were increased or necessary housing upkeep set them back, they could be evicted as their homes were foreclosed and down payments pocketed. The profits were staggering. In 1966, a Chicago landlord told a court that on a single property, he had made $42,500 in rent, but paid only $2,400 in maintenance. When accused of making excessive profits, the landlord simply replied, "That's why I bought the building." The 1968 Civil Rights Act made housing discrimination illegal, but subtler forms prevailed. Crystal and Vanetta wanted to leave the ghetto, but landlords like the one on 15th Street turned them away. Other landlords and property management companies, like Affordable Rentals, tried to avoid discriminating by setting clear criteria and holding all applicants to the same standards. But equal treatment in an unequal society could still foster inequality. Because black men were disproportionately incarcerated and black women disproportionately evicted, uniformly denying housing to applicants with recent criminal or eviction records still had an incommensurate impact on African Americans. When Crystal and Vanetta heard back from Affordable Rentals, they learned their application had been rejected on account of their arrest and eviction history. Eviction itself often explained why some families lived on safe streets and others on dangerous ones, why some children attended good schools and others failing ones. The trauma of being forced from your home, the blemish of an eviction record, and the taxing rush to locate a new place to live pushed evicted renters into more depressed and dangerous areas of the city. This reality had not yet set in for Vanetta and Crystal. They were just coming out of the first fresh feeling phase of house hunting. It was only after they had tried for over 50 apartments that Crystal and Vanetta began reluctantly scouting in the inner city. The new friends were circling back to the ghetto, but not fully committing to it. Crystal had been working to keep her emotions in check. It was why she chose to stop by church Monday night instead of looking for housing. It was why she grabbed her music and sang after the incident with the landlord on 15th Street. "This is too much stress, but I'm not going to make myself sick," she said. When Crystal finally did blow up, it was at one of the shelter's maintenance men over clean linens he refused to supply. She was already in trouble for sleeping through a mandatory job training. Crystal blamed her sleep apnea. After the altercation with the maintenance man, Crystal was told to be out by breakfast the next morning. Crystal spent the following day on the phone, trying to find someone who would open their doors to her. With no luck and night coming on, she sighed and called Minister Barber, who found an older couple in the congregation who agreed to help. Crystal spent the night in their Lazy Boy recliner. The following evening, after Bible study at Mount Calvary, Crystal returned to the elderly couple's house. Rain was falling hard onto dark, empty streets. It was that icy, bitter rain that comes when winter first begins to thaw into spring. Crystal knocked, and the husband cracked the door without unlatching the chain. The house was on 14th and Burleigh, in one of the most crime-ridden areas of the city. Seeing Crystal, the man kept the chain taut, handed over a small bag of Crystal's things, and shut the door. Crystal figured it was because she didn't hit their hand, but she didn't have any money to give, having lent one of her cousins $400, mostly from her casino winnings. Her cousin needed rent money. When Vanetta heard about that, she said, "Crystal, if I was there, I would have smacked the mess out of you. You don't have a place to stay yourself. I don't care if they're your family or not. You've been homeless for a grip, and you need a roof over your own head." Sometimes Crystal couldn't help herself, like the time she and Vanetta were eating lunch at McDonald's and a boy walked in. He was maybe 9 or 10 in dirty clothes and with unkempt hair. One side of his face was swollen. The boy didn't approach the counter. Instead, he wandered slowly through the tables looking for scraps. Crystal and Vanetta noticed him. "What you got?" Crystal asked, riffling through her pockets. The women pooled what they had to buy the boy dinner. Staring up at the menu, Crystal wrapped her arm around the boy like she was his big sister. She made sure he was okay, handed him the food, and sent him away with a hug.
"Reminds me of when we was kids," Vanetta said, shaken.
Crystal watched the boy dash across the street.
"I wish I had me a house. I would take him in."
On Burleigh Street, the wind-pushed rain fell sideways in sheets. In the yellow beam of the streetlight, it looked like an unending school of silvery fish darting through the light before disappearing into the surrounding pool of darkness. Crystal considered her phone. It was almost 11 o'clock at night. She dialed a number. Her cousin, who owed her, didn't pick up. She dialed a number. Her foster care mother said her house was full. She dialed a number. She dialed and dialed and dialed and dialed. 21. Big-headed boy. Sharina had Lamar and Kamala's torched building bulldozed. She used the insurance money to buy 2 new duplexes, doubling the units she had lost to the fire. When the Hingstons looked out their back window, all they saw was a vacant lot. The only remaining visible reminder of that night was a makeshift memorial Kamala and her family set up. Stuffed animals and photographs tied to a tree with a cotton sash cord. The most prominent photograph showed the baby in an Easter dress, her calm eyes large in her small face. For the animals, they had selected rabbits, bears, a goose, a raccoon, and a hippopotamus. Candles in glass vases and Coke cans circled the base of the tree. Natasha was sorting through a garbage bag of baby clothes a friend had picked up at a church pantry. She moved her hands tenderly and smiled at each miniature item. The idea of becoming a mother was growing on her. "I want my baby to have my looks," Natasha said. "I don't want my baby looking like Malik. He got some big old buck eyes." "You so mean," Doreen said. "He all black?" Overhearing, Patrice came into the dining room, wearing her cousin's sub's uniform. "Your baby gonna come out looking like a whole lot of folks," she teased. "No," Natasha laughed. Patrice sighed and changed the subject. "We gotta do something about this toilet, fam." The toilet was stopped up again. So was the kitchen sink, brimming with gray water lined with a rust-orange film. Periodically, someone would bucket it out. This made washing difficult, and dirty pots and plates began accumulating on the counter. So did more roaches and other bugs. Doreen didn't call Sharina about the plumbing. She didn't want a lecture and figured she wouldn't help anyway, since they were still behind. She didn't call a plumber either. Even if she could come up with the money, that would feel too much like helping Sharina, and nobody was interested in doing that, especially after the courthouse letter Patrice had received a few days back. It said she owed $2,494.50, the result of her second and third causes hearing. "I live in that house for 4 months," Patrice had said. "She said I owe her $2,400. "That means you didn't pay any rent at all," Doreen said. "Nah, now you're just making up stuff." Patrice stared at the bill. She thought she owed more like $900. "What are you gonna do?" "I don't know what I can do." The Hingstons expected more of their landlord for the money they were paying her. Rent was their biggest expense by far, and they wanted a decent and functional home in return. They wanted things to be fixed when they broke. But if Sharina wasn't going to repair her own property, neither were they. The house failed the tenants, and the tenants failed the house. The worse the Hingstons' house got, the more everyone seemed to become withdrawn and lethargic, which only deepened the problem. Natasha started spending more time at Malik's, Doreen stopped cooking, and the children ate cereal for dinner. Patrice slept more. The children's grades dropped, and Mikey's teacher called saying he might have to repeat, mainly because of so many missed homework assignments. Everyone had stopped cleaning up, and trash spread over the kitchen floor. Substandard housing was a blow to your psychological health, not only because things like dampness, mold, and overcrowding could bring about depression, but also because of what living in awful conditions told you about yourself. It was once said that the poor are constantly exposed to evidence of their own irrelevance, especially for poor African-American families who live in neighborhoods with rates of violence and concentrated poverty so extreme that even the worst white neighborhoods bear little resemblance. Living in degrading housing in dangerous neighborhoods sent a clear message about where the wider society thought they belonged. "Honestly, this place is a shack," Doreen once said. Not long after that, Ruby came through the door and announced that a man just got killed right in front of the store. Growing up in a shack, in the ghetto, meant learning how to endure such an environment while also learning that some people never had to. People who were repulsed by their home, who felt they had no control over it, and yet had to give most of their income to it, they thought less of themselves. The older children found some reprieve from the apartment in the public library on Center Street. CJ, Ruby, and Mikey liked playing on the computer best. Ruby would begin her time there by checking in on her house, which she had gradually built up and improved through a free online game called Millsbury, a marketing tool created by General Mills. Her house was located on Bounty Drive in Golden Valley. It had clean, light-reflecting floors, a bed with sheets and pillowcases, and a desk for doing schoolwork. Doreen or Patrice could have walked to the library and searched for new housing on the internet, but they never did. This was partially because paying Sharina back meant they didn't have enough money to move. Partially because, like most black renters, they didn't search for housing online. And partially because the family had sunk into a hazy depression. Patrice could feel the house sucking their energy. "We just hit a mud hole with this house," she said. "No one's trying to get better. Makes me not want to get better. If you're around people every day that doesn't want to do anything, eventually you will feel like doing nothing." Tennessee was sounding better to her by the day. When it was time, Malik rushed from work to meet Natasha at the hospital, Wheaton Franciscan, St. Joseph campus, on Chambers and 49th Street. She looked ready and scared. She clutched the bed railing with one hand and Malik's hand with the other. When Malik would try to stand up, Natasha would pull him back down. He would smile and rub her back. She focused on her breathing, just like they had practiced in birthing class. Doreen watched knowingly from the rocking chair, arms folded over her stomach. The baby came at 11:10 p.m., weighing 8 pounds, 3 ounces. He was round-faced with a full shock of hair, pinkish-brown skin, and a broad Hingston nose. As she lay sleeping the next morning, Natasha heard Patrice whisper, "Hey, Mama," in her ear. She smiled before opening her eyes. When the baby stirred, he was passed around, though Natasha had a hard time letting him go. All day long, she lifted him to her and kissed him softly on the nose and forehead. Patrice noticed Malik's proud face and decided then and there to name the baby Malik Jr. The next day, Natasha swaddled her tiny, cherished boy and took him back to the rat hole. 22. If they give Mama the punishment. In April, Vanetta hid candy Easter eggs around the lodge for her children to find. Kendall let Tembi and Bobo collect them. Sometimes, the boy already seemed finished with childhood. At 4 years old, he refused to hold Vanetta's hand and didn't like singing in his preschool class. A handsome boy, with pinched lips and espresso-colored eyes, he intuited that his mama had enough to worry about. This, of course, made Vanetta worry. A few days before Easter, Tembi pulled the fire alarm. When management found out who was responsible, they told Vanetta she had to be out the next day. Vanetta didn't waste much time protesting. She headed straight for the heart of the ghetto and began calling on apartments. She called on every rent sign she saw, regardless of the condition of the house or the neighborhood. She toured a dirty apartment with cracks down the walls and grease on the ceiling on a block with abandoned homes and gang graffiti. She hated it and filled out an application. "Girl, you got put out because of your kids?" Crystal asked. That cold night on the porch, Crystal had finally gotten a hold of a cousin who allowed her to spend the night. After that, Crystal began sleeping in the waiting room of Wheaton Franciscan, which she called St. Joseph's Hospital, and the newly remodeled Amtrak station downtown, where she tried blending in with waiting passengers. One day at a bus stop, she met a woman named Patricia. They were roommates by day's end. Crystal needed a place to stay, and Patricia, who had been plotting to toss her abusive husband, needed an income to replace his. Patricia was twice Crystal's age, with a teenage daughter and a single-family home in one of the quieter sections of the North Side. Crystal began calling Patricia Mom. The next day, Vanetta checked out of the lodge and took her things to her older sister's apartment. Ebony lived on Orchard Street, a residential street near the Hispanic Mission, in a small three-bedroom upper with her husband, three kids, and Vanetta's younger sister. The place was cluttered and worn, with a stained beige carpet, mattresses in almost every room, and a small kitchen tucked in the back. Vanetta wasn't planning on staying long. She gave her sister $50, moved her kids into one of the small bedrooms, and headed downtown to the courthouse for Deshaun's reconfinement hearing. Deshaun was Bobo's father, and Vanetta thought she loved him. He was a good dad when he wasn't drinking. The police had picked him up 6 months earlier for a parole violation linked to a drug possession charge. As the judge weighed the facts of the case, he cited several 911 calls Vanetta had made when Deshaun got rough. And then on October 10, a call from Vanetta Evans, and then on October 19, another call from Ms. Evans. Mortified, Vanetta put her hands in her face and cried. She remembered those calls and what had happened after she kicked Deshaun out. He returned later, drunk, smashed the door down, and beat her. After that incident, Vanetta remembered the landlord taking her rent money with one hand and handing her a 28-day no-cause eviction notice with the other. At the reconfinement hearing, the judge gave Deshaun 18 months. Vanetta almost never drank, but that night, she bought a bottle of New Amsterdam gin and passed out next to her children. She slept through Crystal's phone call. So Crystal hung up and dialed her cousins and foster sisters. Her arrangement with Patricia had come undone. Patricia's 14-year-old daughter had taken Crystal's cell phone to school and either lost or sold it. Crystal demanded compensation, but Patricia refused to pay. "I'm going to get you out of my house," Patricia yelled, drunk on wine mixed with E&J brandy. Crystal called her people for backup. They waited in the car. The women took their argument outside, and Patricia lost her balance and fell to the ground. Staring down, Crystal lifted her foot and brought it down on Patricia's face again and again. Seeing this, one of Crystal's sisters ran up and hit Patricia with a hammer. "Bitch, try it again," she yelled before pulling Crystal away. In pain, Patricia lay still on the sidewalk in a fetal position. Crystal asked to be dropped off at St. Joseph's Hospital, where she spent the night. After trying for 73 places, Vanetta and Crystal were approved for a $500 a month two-bedroom apartment. Desperate tenants willing to overlook neglected repairs had found a desperate landlord willing to overlook evictions and convictions. The apartment's wood floors were sticky with grime, the front door didn't lock properly, and the bedrooms were so small they couldn't hold much more than a twin bed. In the kitchen, the sink was clogged, the floor tiles were chipped, and there was a wall of cabinets sealed shut with laminating paper. There were empty spaces where a stove and refrigerator once had been. There was, however, a tub, and the place was on 7th and Maple, on the near south side. You could see St. Stanislaus's twin steeples from the kitchen window. Vanetta thought it was a dangerous block. She had known the drug dealer on the corner since childhood. "It's wretched, but I'm tired of looking," Vanetta said. "I don't want to take it, but it's the only option I got." The new friends moved into the apartment with a few garbage bags of clothes and toys between them. Crystal had left most of her things at Patricia's and considered them gone for good. The only piece of furniture in the place was an old upholstered rocking chair someone had left behind. Vanetta and Crystal's plan was to stay for a year. But not long after moving in, Clara, a woman Crystal and Vanetta knew from the lodge, came over and used up Crystal's cell phone minutes. So Crystal put her through one of the apartment's windows. When the cops showed up, Crystal made herself a couple of sandwiches for the road. Vanetta used most of what she had saved at the shelter to pay for the shattered window and told Crystal not to come back. It was the only way the landlord would allow Vanetta and her children to stay. A few days later, Child Protective Services called Ebony's apartment asking for Vanetta. When Ebony called Vanetta to warn her, Vanetta suspected Crystal. "I'm gonna kill that bitch," she vented to Shortcake. "Do you know that bitch called social services on me?" "You poured salt on her. Now she's gonna pour salt on you," Shortcake said.
"She pouring salt on my kids," Vanetta cried.
The news about CPS had unnerved Vanetta. She didn't think they would allow her children to stay in an apartment with no stove or refrigerator. Vanetta was broke, but she went to a used appliances corner store anyway. Spanish music played over a clutter of used dishwashers, dryers, and other appliances. The owner, Mr. Rodriguez, a pudgy Mexican man with thick hair, identified different units piled in his small store with a stick resembling a teacher's pointer. "How much is your cheapest stove and cheapest refrigerator?" Vanetta asked. "Baking? No baking?" Rodriguez asked with a thick accent. Vanetta shook her head, no. She would be fine with a non-working oven. Rodriguez poked his stick in the direction of a small gas stove. "How much?" Vanetta asked. 90. She shook her head, no, again. "Too high." "How much?" Rodriguez shrugged. They went back and forth until Vanetta talked Rodriguez down to $80, including the hose piece, which she had wanted to sell separately. She found a refrigerator somewhere else and talked the guy down to $60. She borrowed the money from a friend, promising to pay it back the first of the month, and finished the day shopping at Aldi. At the checkout counter, she placed the ice cream sandwiches and other junk food at the end of the conveyor belt, in case she ran out of food stamps and needed to put something back. After unloading the groceries, Vanetta slumped down, exhausted, in the rocking chair, and lit a cigarette. If CPS came knocking, she was ready for them. Then other thoughts drifted in. She was still undecided about who she wanted to care for her children if she was sent to prison for the robbery. Lately, she was leaning toward a woman from her children's daycare. "I might go crazy, but I know they'd be taken care of," Vanetta told herself. Then there was Kendall's upcoming preschool graduation. Vanetta wanted to somehow find money to buy him a new pair of shoes for the big day. She wanted him to feel special, accomplished. In the inner city, much was made of early milestones. Later ones might never come. The morning of her sentencing hearing, Vanetta roused her children, fed and dressed them, and began re-ironing her outfit on the living room floor. Besides installing the stove and refrigerator, she hadn't been able to do much else in the apartment, and it felt empty, unlived in. Kendall joined Vanetta in the living room, standing with his hands at his sides in the tawny glow of the morning. She addressed him in a red-collared shirt and his new shoes. A few feet away, a picture of him at his preschool graduation in a cap and gown was displayed on the mantel. "Mama," Kendall said, "kids aren't supposed to go to court. They're supposed to go to daycare and school." He wasn't pouting. He was observing some strangeness in the world, a misalignment. He could have been saying, "Dogs aren't supposed to like cats," or "It's not supposed to snow in April." Vanetta put down the iron and took a breath. "Kendall, will you come to court with me?" she asked, just as she had the night before. Kendall saw that she needed him. "Mama, I will go to court with you," he said decisively. "If they give Mama the punishment, what you supposed to do? Stick together, take care of my sister and brother, and listen to my TT?" At the last minute, Vanetta had decided to ask her sister to care for her kids if she was sent away. She couldn't say why. Vanetta arrived at court early, quietly shaking under a conservative black sweater and matching slacks. She had put on makeup and earrings and had pulled her hair tight around her head. She paced the hallway, trying to think of what she would say to the judge, periodically stopping to watch the ponderous gait of shackled black men in orange prison uniforms. Shortcake showed up in a knit cap and winter coat, along with Vanetta's twin brother and younger sister. Ebony stayed home and watched Tembi, Bobo, and the rest of the kids. Later, the preacher's wife and another white woman from the All-Bible Baptist Church, Vanetta's congregation, would join them in knit sweaters and thick glasses. When it was time, Vanetta took a seat next to her public defender, a foot-tapping white man in a plain black suit. The courtroom didn't look like the kind you see on television, those open-air theaters with balconies, large ceiling fans, and people crowded into wooden pews. It was a small space, separated from the audience by a thick wall of glass. Ceiling speakers broadcast court proceedings to onlookers. The prosecution went first, represented by a fit, pink-faced assistant district attorney with thinning hair and trimmed beard. Many things about Vanetta impressed him. She had not been arrested before and had some employment history. She apparently attended school into the 11th grade. That is better education, as sad as that is. That's better education than many of the defendants that we see. He continued. She has family support. That's good. Unfortunately, that same level of emotional and family support was available at the time of this offense and by itself wasn't sufficient. I don't doubt that the decision was driven by desperation, but the fact that it was desperation does not minimize its impact on the victims. One of the victims didn't carry a purse anymore and didn't feel safe in her neighborhood, the prosecutor reported. It is the state's view that people need to know when you use a gun to take things from other people, you go to prison. Vanetta's public defender spoke next, offering a sprawling but impassioned case for leniency. Vanetta was remorseful, he said, and had confessed to the crime. She was younger and less street smart than her accomplices. Her friend had held the gun. It was a crime of mean circumstances. I believe punishment can be accomplished in a community setting, the public defender concluded. I don't believe that you have to send her away. It was Vanetta's turn to speak next. She took full responsibility for her actions and apologized to the victims and the court. At the time of this situation, me and my kids were going through a difficult time in our lives and on the verge of being evicted and our lights being cut off. I was overwhelmed by the difficulties. But this doesn't excuse what I have done. At this time, I'm asking for leniency for me, but especially for my children. Then it was time for people to speak on Vanetta's behalf. The preacher's wife said, I have observed in her a quiet calmness in the midst of trying circumstances. Shortcake offered four sentences. Vanetta's twin brother said that they had just made 21 and that his sister's children needed to wake up to their mother, not to their aunties and uncles. Finally, it was the judge's turn. An older white man, he began to recap what he had just heard. So this was a general discussion about the nature of this offense, basically, that it was an aberration, a crime of desperation. I look at that. But I'm also mindful of the fact that between then and now, nothing has really changed. I'm saying that the overall economic situation hasn't improved. Has it, counsel? No, the public defender answered. He had argued that Vanetta had been looking for work. He hadn't pointed out that Vanetta rose at 5 each morning, but still had little time to find a job between searching for a new place to live, attending GED classes, and caring for her children, or that employers usually did not hire people who had recently confessed to committing a felony. No, the judge repeated. And quite honestly, I don't know that it got any better after that time. Maybe a little worse, based upon what's occurred and the fact that she's kicked around and moved around. What the judge was saying, in essence, was, we all agree that you were poor and scared when you did this violent, hurtful thing. And if you had been allowed to go on working 5 days a week at Old Country Buffet, refilling soup pots and mopping up frozen yogurt spills, none of us would be here right now. You might have been able to save enough money to move to an apartment that was de-leaded and clean in a neighborhood without drug dealers and with safe schools. With time, you may have been able to get Bobo the medical treatment he needs for his seizures, and maybe you could have even started taking night classes to become a nurse, like you always wanted. And, who knows, maybe you could have actually become a nurse, a real nurse with a uniform and everything. Then you could really give your kids a childhood that would look nothing like the one Shortcake gave you. If you did that, you would walk around this cold city with your head held high, and maybe you would eventually come to feel that you were worth something and deserving of a man who could support you other than by lending you his pistol for a stick-up, or at least one who didn't break down your door and beat you in front of your children. Maybe you would meet someone with a steady job and get married in a small church, with Kendall standing proudly up front by the groom and Tembi as the poofy-dressed flower girl and Bobo as the grinning, toddling ring-bearer. Just like you always dreamed it. And from that day on, your groom would introduce you as my wife. But that's not what happened. What happened was that your hours were cut, and your electricity was about to be shut off, and you and your children were about to be thrown out of your home, and you snatched someone's purse as your friend pointed a gun at her face. And if it was poverty that caused this crime, who's to say you won't do it again? Because you were poor then, and you are poor now. We all see the underlying cause. We see it every day in this court. But the justice system is no charity, no jobs program, no housing authority. If we cannot pull the weed up from the roots, then at least we can cut it low at the stem. The judge sighed, and a silent moment passed. The court stenographer steadied her hands above the keys and waited. Kendall, asleep on Shortcake's lap, breathed noiselessly. The judge ruled. This is not a probationary case. I am going to impose 81 months in the state prison system. It's going to break down to 15 months of initial confinement and 66 months of extended supervision. The bailiff approached Vanetta and told her to stand to be handcuffed.
Oh, God, Shortcake let out. She shook Kendall awake and took him to the glass. Wave goodbye, son.
Hands behind her back, Vanetta turned around, tears streaming down her cheeks. Kendall stared back, stone-faced, strong, just like his mama had taught him. After getting into several conflicts with congregants, bishops, and eventually her minister, Crystal left Mount Calvary and joined Restoration International Ministries, an inner-city church in a bland two-story office building on 41st and Burleigh. One Sunday, Crystal sat in the third pew from the front and began clapping with the music. She wore a black shirt and green pants, unbuttoned and unzipped halfway, to fit. The pastor, a black woman with hair falling in arching waves down to her shoulders, wore a white robe with gold accents. She paced with a queen's authority, stopping as the Spirit led her. God says he is the truth and the light, she said. The young man at the piano fluttered his hands, and the even younger fellow behind the drums began teasing a cymbal. The truth and the light. You hearing me?
Amen, Crystal said.
After being kicked out of her apartment with Vanetta, Crystal was admitted to a homeless shelter. Then through a weary, looping rhythm, make a friend, use a friend, lose a friend, Crystal found, for short bursts, dry and warm places to sleep. When those bridges burned, she dropped back into street homelessness, returning to St. Joseph's or the Amtrak station. Sometimes, she would walk the streets all night and sleep on the bus once morning broke. But through it all, she almost never missed church.
Sha-la-la-la-yaba-sho-ta-ta-ma-ma-ma.
The pastor prayed into a microphone. The language of tongues was spoken in a cadence, the shape of a heartbeat, a small entrance followed by a spike, then a quivering trailing off.
Are you in the press? Are you squeezing yourself up into the crowd to see Jesus? Whoa!
She stumbled back, as if bumped by an invisible force.
All right, Pastor,
Crystal hollered. Crystal had always believed that SSI was a more secure income source than a paycheck. You couldn't get fired from SSI. Your hours couldn't get cut.
SSI always come, she said,
until one day it didn't. She had been approved for SSI as a minor, but her adult reevaluation found her ineligible. Now, Crystal's only source of income came from food stamps. She tried donating plasma, but her veins were too small. She asked her spiritual, foster, and even biological mothers for money, but what they could give her didn't go very far. She didn't ask anything from her church because it always led to conflict. Because she didn't know what else to do, Crystal went on the stroll and began selling sex. She had never been a morning person, but soon learned that it was the best time to turn tricks, catching men on their way to work.
Is Mama okay?
The pastor asked. She was looking at an older woman being held up by two people.
No. Then we're going to stop everything and pray for her.
The pastor knelt down in front of the woman. A dozen or so churchgoers surrounded her, some standing on chairs, some with their hands on the old woman's head.
Reach out your hands this way and pray,
the pastor commanded, and her congregation obeyed, even the children.
Oh, Jesus,
the pastor yelled into the microphone.
Oh, by the blood, oh, you death spirit, you stroke spirit. Come out!
Crystal was bouncing and moving her hands from shoulders to hips, chanting,
By your stripes, Lord, by your stripes.
By the blood, prayed the pastor. The blood,
Shababma Shaktala. I bind you. Come back, Mama. Come back.
The music simmered low, waiting. The clutch of people surrounding the older woman parted, revealing her limp and blood-drained face. She looked to be asleep or dead. Then the huddle closed in again. After a few minutes, the people encircling the woman grew louder and stepped outward to show the pastor kissing the woman about her face and hands. People began clapping as the woman rose to her feet.
Praise God,
the pastor said. She let out a triumphant scream into the microphone and collapsed to her knees, praying. The piano and drums kicked up, and the church exploded. People began running up and down the aisle, shouting and singing. Someone found a tambourine and started pounding it. The drummer crashed the cymbals, and the pianist lingered on the high notes. A woman yelled and sprinted in place, sweat streaming down her face.
"We ain't trying to have no funeral up in here,"
the pastor boasted. And there was Crystal, hands raised, fingers spread, beaming and dancing. "God got me," she cried. "God got me." 23. The Serenity Club. Scott had been 8 days sober when he went to the Serenity Club, a smoke-filled, wood-paneled AA bar that served stale coffee and root beer floats.
"They're addictive," one regular with a rap sheet said about the floats, "but I don't do robberies for them."
When it was time for the speakers, a light-skinned Puerto Rican woman in a black bandana and vinyl jacket took the podium. This was Anna Aldea, an acid-dropping, coke-snorting, cowhide-tough biker lady turned high priestess of AA. A few months shy of her 10-year chip, Anna had helped dozens of addicts through the program. During her speech, she pointed to her newest project.
"I love you, Scott," she said. "Keep coming back. It works. If you work it," the room finished. A week prior, Scott had woken up from his 3-day bender, broke and hungover. To still his nerves, he dressed and left his apartment. It was early Saturday morning, and Scott walked as the city slept. He made it all the way to Pito's house and got him out of bed. 2 years sober himself, Pito knew what to do with a detoxing junkie who wanted to get clean. Plenty of water, coffee, vitamins, cigarettes, food, and above all, constant monitoring. Pito stayed with Scott all day, and that evening took him to meet his brother, David, 14 years sober, and his wife, Anna. Anna lit a fire in their backyard pit and sat up with Scott until the bars closed at 2 a.m. It was a nauseating, painful, stretched-out day, Scott's first drug-free in years. Day 5 was miserable in a different way. Scott passed it, sobbing, at Pito's house. "I can feel my body getting better," he said. "But when you have years and years and years of not feeling anything from drinking and dope, then it kind of hits you."
AA had its own binge for people starting to get sober. 90 meetings in 90 days. The idea was to surround the baby, their slang for newcomer, with a support structure that would replace his junkie network, and to never leave him alone. So Scott began showing up at Pito's before the liquor stores opened at 8 a.m., and ending his days around Anna's fire pit after last call. Scott was almost 3 weeks sober when his landlord told him to go. DP's newly acquired pit bull had got out and somehow snuck into the downstairs neighbor's apartment. The neighbors called the police, who called the landlord, who, wanting to keep his long-term tenants, gave Scott and DP the boot. By that time, Scott was basically living at David and Anna's. They told him he might as well sleep there, too. David and Anna's working-class home was one of those places that seemed to belong to everybody. People would walk through the door without knocking and open the refrigerator without asking.
"This is the Aldea Recovery House," Anna would say. "If somebody's not here, somebody's calling."
She kept large bowls of rice and beans on hand and never locked the door. Scott began sleeping on the Aldea's couch and picking up their children from school. Soon, he began working with David, a freelance mason and, in lean weeks, a metal scrapper. Scott liked the work, especially the urban adventure of hunting for aluminum or steel scraps, even if it did involve the occasional dumpster dive. A barrel-chested Puerto Rican man with pinched eyes and a ready grin,
Sometimes David paid Scott, and sometimes he didn't. Scott didn't complain. How could he, after what David and Anna had done for him? At first, Scott liked cleaning the Serenity Club. The pay was piddly, $7.15 an hour, which would give him around $100 a week. But because he worked alone from 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. most nights, it gave him time to think. He thought about finding someone, although he didn't know where to start if not in a gay bar. Craigslist? He thought about his sister's wedding. Maybe he could make it home for that. He prayed, "Please don't let me use tomorrow." But most of all, he would dream about returning to nursing. He thought that would be a great way to stay sober because you start thinking about other people and not your poor pathetic shit. But the road ahead felt daunting. The nursing board didn't just take Scott's license away. Understandably, it made it extremely difficult for him to earn it back. He would have to submit to the testing of urine specimens at a frequency of not less than 56 times per year, which would cost thousands of dollars. He'd have to stay clean for 5 years and attend bi-weekly AA meetings. Scott recognized his weaknesses. He didn't know if he would have tried harder to get clean years ago if the nursing board had not put license reinstatement so far out of reach. But giving up did come easier when things seemed impossible. The impaired professionals gathering had left him discouraged, too. One nurse said it had taken her over a year to find a job after being sober for about 2 years and passing all the requirements, and she had a master's degree. There were stations between having a revoked nursing license and having one with full privileges, but to get a nursing job with a restricted license, one that didn't allow you to handle narcotics, say, was rare. Scott knew people. Over the years, he had stayed in touch with several nursing pals, and some had moved into positions of influence. He even had an aunt who was the dean of nursing at a large state university nearby. But staying in touch with these people had meant hiding his addiction and poverty, so approaching them for help was complicated. The last time Scott spoke with a friend who was the director of a local nursing home, he said he was doing fine. So now I'd have to go back and say, "Oh no, I really wasn't doing well. I was still a junkie. I totally lied to you." I guess that's where a lot of my reservations would come in. Scott didn't feel he could call in any favors. After 4 months of cleaning the club with only one night off in total, Scott began to grow weary. He was sober and bored. He would empty the ashtrays, scrub the toilets, and, at the end of the night, grade his performance. A-minus, C-plus. Then 21 hours later, he would do it all again. At least when he was a junkie, his life had purpose. Get dope. Now he felt as though he were pacing in a small, dull loop. Anna had asked Scott to pay $200 a month to sleep on the couch and to put his food stamps toward groceries, which made it difficult for him to save much. It was more than just his work at the club. As the initial high of sobriety wore off, Scott began to sour on AA in general. This post-honeymoon sensation was so common that AA had a phrase for it: falling off your pink cloud. "Ambivalence has turned into animosity," Scott said. It embarrassed him, spending nights in folding chair semicircles with washed-up drunks and cokeheads, drinking Folgers out of styrofoam cups and swapping horror stories. Scott grew to hate the rituals, the stranger's hand on his shoulder, the hoary sayings, "But by the grace of God, let go and let God." Not to mention the Serenity Club crowd's belief that fighting addiction with a prescription, methadone, say, was cheating. Scott was considering going to the county clinic to get something to help with the cravings and depression, but he couldn't tell Anna or David. Scott had puked and shivered and wept to push the poison out of his system, only to look around and see that he was still broke and homeless, logging stupid hours at AA and dipping a mop into a bucket at midnight. "Fucking addicts and drunks," he would yell into an empty room whose folding chairs had not been put back. "This makes me crazy." At 7:37 a.m., Scott signed into the Milwaukee County Behavioral Services Division Access Clinic. The clinic served residents with no insurance or only GAMP, Milwaukee County's public insurance. A sign on the wall announced, "Your first appointment may last 3 to 5 hours. If you didn't have the money, you would pay with your time." Nurses and social workers bustled past patients strolling the hallways, doing nothing while they waited. Scott wouldn't mind working at the clinic, being one of the fast walkers. But on that day, he was there for drugs. To him, what the AA converts didn't understand, because none of them were heroin users, was that his body was physically in need of something that would give him a boost and kickstart his motivation. His fingers were crossed for Suboxone, which was used to treat opiate addiction. After almost 3 hours, Scott's name was called. He stood up, relieved to be seen. The psychiatrist was a skinny Asian man with a flat top and a voice just above a whisper. He led Scott into a drab, rectangular room that resembled an oversized closet. Scott sat on a couch and the psychiatrist bent over an old desk, reading Scott's file. The desk was pushed against the wall so that when Scott looked up from the couch, he saw the psychiatrist in profile.
"How long have you been depressed?"
the psychiatrist asked, staring at the file.
"A long time," Scott answered. "So what kind of symptoms are you having?"
"I just really don't have any energy. I'm thinking about looking into Suboxone. I can't tell if I'm in post-withdrawal."
"How long have you had trouble with the drugs?"
"I'd say about 7 years."
"And how long have you been clean?"
4 months. After Scott filled him in about his drug use, the psychiatrist paused before the next question.
He continued. "It says here that you were sexually abused when you were younger."
"Correct."
Scott sniffed.
"How old were you?"
"Young.
From 4 to..."
Scott thought for a moment.
10.
"Who was the perpetrator?"
Scott told him.
"So how did it end? Was someone told?"
"No, I never told anybody about it."
"Have you ever got any treatment for that?"
"No."
"You have any interest in that?"
"No." Scott walked out of the clinic with 2 bottles of antidepressants. He was to take 100 milligrams of Zoloft twice a day and 50 milligrams of amitriptyline at bedtime. When Scott had asked, "Do you suggest anything to help with the cravings?" the doctor had mentioned treatment programs instead of Suboxone. Scott had been a little bummed at that response, but 2 out of 3 wasn't bad. It was cold outside, -1 degrees without the wind chill. Under Scott's boots, the snow squeaked. 3 months later, while rooting around for loose change, David and Anna Aldea's 12-year-old daughter found a syringe in Scott's swimming trunks. Oscar, the Aldea's eldest son, who had recently moved back home, floated the possibility of it being an old needle, which was entirely plausible. When Scott had first moved in, he would periodically find paraphernalia in the pocket of a sweatshirt or pair of jeans he hadn't worn in a while. He even found a crack pipe once, looking at it and remembering, the way you do when finding a faded ticket stub in the laundry. But David and Anna weren't buying it. That night, after Scott had finished cleaning the Serenity Club, he discovered his things on the Aldea's porch with a note. He tried the door. Locked. Theirs had been his home for 7 months. Scott didn't plead his case. He shunned confrontation, and David and Anna wouldn't have believed him anyway.
"It's much easier for them to think that it was mine than his," Scott reflected.
Besides, this was no time for Oscar to detox, having just become a father. The unselfish thing to do, in Scott's mind, was to allow Oscar to keep using so that he could be there for his girlfriend and baby daughter. Scott knew the needle was Oscar's because Scott had shot up with him. Scott wouldn't use the term relapse. He would say, "It just made me normal." Several things had happened all at once. First, Scott learned that all those AA meetings he had sat through and all those group therapy sessions, which he hated even more, didn't count toward his nursing license. The nursing board had its own procedure, and Scott hadn't followed it. The board also had its own lab for urine screening, and since Scott hadn't used it, all those clean drops he'd been racking up didn't count either. "I went and pissed in the cup, and I did that for weeks and weeks and weeks, and finally I contacted the board to make sure that it was all okay, and they were like, no." Just days after hearing this defeat, Scott ran into heroin Susie and Billy at a gas station. They offered, and he accepted, a quiet act of rebellion. That might have been an isolated incident, a small backslip on his steep climb, but then Oscar moved in with a full-blown habit.
The two began getting high on the weekends together. Scott would stop using by Monday so that he could piss clean on Friday.